The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Our guests this evening hail from Brooklyn, have published 5 books, share an agent, and were born just a few years apart. They're also talented artists whose latest works feature unusual story structures and female protagonists searching for recognition. A reviewer in the Boston Globe writes, "Susan Choi's thrilling new novel, Trust Exercise, is a rare and splendid literary creature, piercingly intelligent, engrossingly entertaining, and so masterfully intricate that only after you've finished it, stunned, can you step back and marvel at the full scope of its unshowy achievements." Susan Choi's earlier novels include the Asian American Literary Award-winning The Foreign Student, American Woman, a finalist for the 2004 Pulitzer Prize, A Person of Interest, a finalist for the 2009 Penn Faulkner Award, and My Education, winner of the Lambda Literary Award for Bisexual Fiction. A creative writing teacher at Yale, Choi has earned Guggenheim and National Endowment for the Arts fellowships. Myla Goldberg is the author of the best-selling Bee Season, the story of a family's disintegration told through the lens of a young spelling prodigy. It was a New York Times notable book, a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award, and the New York Public Library's Young Lions Fiction Award, and it was adapted into a film starring Richard Gere. Goldberg's more recent novels include Wicket's Remedy, which was described as layered and ingenious, and The False Friend, praised for the author's psychological shrewdness, generosity, and sure hand. She is also one of the few contemporary novelists immortalized in popular song. If you ask the inner tubes about Song for Myla Goldberg, you'll hear a lovely and zany track by the Portland band, The Decemberists. In a recent review for Newsday, author Marion Winnick writes that Goldberg's Feast Your Eyes is the first novel that has brought me to tears in a long time, out of the intensity of my involvement with its characters and concerns, which revolve around the tension between being a mother, a single mother, and being an artist. Feast Your Eyes becomes a universal and profound story of love and loss. Please welcome our first presenter, Myla Goldberg.
Thanks. Hey, everybody. I'm reading from the beginning of this, so I don't need to tell you anything in advance. I'm just gonna start and we'll go from there. I was 10 when I saw it, Pop sitting across the breakfast table with his Daily News and his cigarette. I looked up from my cornflakes, and there it was, staring at me from the front page, a little kid in her underwear with black bars printed over her eyes and her chest. She was holding out a glass of milk to some woman lying on a bed, and there was a dark spot on the sheet between the woman's legs. The headline above the photo was the same monster size they used when JFK got shot the year before. Judge rules, Mommy is sick. Man, I thought, that girl must have made her mom sick with a glass of milk and made her bleed. She had to be real trouble, that girl, because how else do you get your photo on the front page of the newspaper? On the TV news that night, she was crossed out just the same, this time sitting on a couch in a beaded necklace. Walter Cronkite said her name was Samantha and her mother was a photographer, Lillian Preston. The pictures in the paper and on TV were from 7 photographs that he called the Samantha series. They had been on display in a photography show until the gallery got shut down because Samantha was mostly naked in the pictures, not to mention that the photo from the morning paper, which was actually called Mommy is Sick, had to do with abortion. I didn't know what abortion was, except it was against the law and some kind of a sin, but that was enough. I grabbed the Daily News from the trash bin and stashed it under my bed, and that was how Samantha Preston became a dark goddess to me. Whenever the world went gray, I would pull out Mommy is Sick and stare at a girl who was 10 times worse trouble than I ever was until I'd start to feel better. I was 20 before I saw the photo again. I'd been in the city a few years, working lousy jobs and going to shows, and my friend Brian and I decided to start a band. As I was looking through one of his crazy scrapbooks, there it was, same picture, same headline. The song came to me right away, like I'd been writing it in my head all that time. When we put out Mommy Is Sick as a single, we used a repro of the newspaper clipping for the record sleeve because there was no one to tell us not to. Then we got signed, and they told us we had to ask permission for that kind of thing. But it had been 10 years, and no one we asked even knew who Lillian Preston was. So for the album cover, we made our own version. Brian in bed with ketchup between his legs, and me in my underwear holding out the milk glass, black grease paint over my eyes, and black electrical tape over my B cups. By the time we were asked to play Saturday Night Live, I was performing in that getup only for special occasions, but national live TV is as special as it comes, which is why America saw just half of Mommy Is Sick before I ripped off my dress and the network cut to a commercial. A few days later, the phone rang. I picked up and a voice asked, "Are you Frances Pell?" "Who's this?" I said. "This is Samantha," said the voice on the phone. "Samantha who?" There was a pause, then a click, and then it was too late. After that, Brian and I were touring a lot, doing all the stupid things people do living that kind of a life. Whenever we came back to New York, our manager would drop off a box of band mail that had been sent to the label. To sort through it, Brian and I would spend hours holed up in his apartment drinking Jack and Coke. People sent all kinds of stuff, poetry, drawings, love letters, hate letters. One night, I opened a big yellow envelope with my name on it, and inside was a picture of me sitting cross-legged on the hood of a car. I had no memory of anyone taking that photo, or of sitting on that car to begin with, which wasn't unusual in those days, but it felt like I'd been spied on. Brian was pissed when I tore the photo in half. He said it was a great shot, but what mattered to me was the invasion of privacy. After Brian grabbed the envelope, he read the note that came with it, then started shaking his head. "Nice job, shithead. You just tore up a photograph by Lillian Preston," he said. When he showed me her name, I wanted to kick my own ass. For the next 20-odd years of making music, my Lillian Preston story stayed filed away with everything else I wished I'd done differently, until I got a call from a curator at the Museum of Modern Art. They were planning a Lillian Preston show. Would I take a look at the photographs, maybe write something for the catalog? I figured this would be my chance to thank her. The math in my head told me Lillian Preston was in her 50s, so when I got there, I was looking for a middle-aged person. Waiting for me in the curator's office instead was a woman about my age. I was pretty sure I'd seen her somewhere, but that's a feeling I get all the time. Then she said, "Are you Frances Pell?" "Don't hang up," yelled the voice inside my head. "I know who you are." For the rest of that day, we looked at her mother's photographs. I thought they'd all be naked people, but they weren't, at least not in the usual way. Lillian Preston was mostly a street photographer. She lived her life blending into backgrounds and snapping whoever passed by. For all that, these people aren't strangers. Sometimes it's a look in the eyes or the way someone is standing, but what's unfamiliar lifts away. The people in Lillian Preston's pictures seem like people I know. Sometimes, looking at a stranger, it even feels like I'm looking at myself. I'll be honest, I didn't always like what I saw. It's hard being jolted like that, time after time, truth after truth, in black and white. But it's also beautiful. These photos, whatever else they may be, are also beautiful. Some of them are from before anyone heard of Lillian Preston or the Samantha series, but most are from the years that came after Lillian and her daughter had been threatened, followed, and forced to change their address and phone number. After Lillian had been called brilliant, poetic, brave, visionary, exploitative, criminal, neglectful, selfish, and a bad mother. By 1973, when the Supreme Court finally got around to changing the definition of what was obscene, not to mention rewriting abortion law, Lillian Preston had pretty much stopped showing her pictures to anyone. Luckily, that wasn't the same thing as not making pictures at all. If you're reading this, you already know all that. You've seen the photographs at the show, or you've looked through the images in the front half of this catalog, and you've seen all that hard beauty for yourself. So let me tell you something you don't know. Aside from the 7,000 rolls of film and hundreds of prints Lillian left behind when she died, separate from the binders of technical notes were three boxes. Box one held Lillian's 24 journals from the summer she split Cleveland at age 17 to the day cancer killed her at 40. Box two contained the prints she'd made for this exhibition, plus a letter asking her daughter to bring them to MoMA in case they might do for her dead what they'd never done for her alive. Box three had the prints and negatives from the Samantha series and a letter giving her daughter a choice: destroy them or include them with the prints in box two. Believe it or not, the woman Samantha Jane Preston turned into was going to let some curatorial shirt write about the photographs in this exhibition. "Are you crazy?" I told her. "The only one who can do that is you. You're the one who lived with Lillian, who fought with her, who knew her friends, who went through the whole Samantha thing and came out the other end. Use everything. Use her diaries, use her letters. Go back and talk to the important people in her life to show her work in a way that an art establishment type never could." I got a long stare after that, or what I thought was a long stare, until I realized that she'd gone somewhere deep inside herself and I just happened to be standing in front of her. Then, in a quiet voice that was for herself more than anyone else, she said, "It's too late for a lot of things, but I guess it's not too late for that." And so, this catalog was written by someone whose life was tangled up in these photographs, along with the lives of all the people who helped make them, whether they were standing in front of the camera, behind the camera, or somewhere off to the side. Because of that, it's not like any catalog you've read before. It's personal. It's unprofessional. And when the art establishment type saw it, they were smart enough to leave it alone. Frances Pell, a.k.a. Franny Panic, New York, 1990. Catalog. All works are by Lillian Preston, unless otherwise noted, and are from the artist's estate. Greenwich Village, 1953 through 54. 1. Untitled. Prentice High Camera Club, Cleveland, 1951. Unknown photographer. Feast your eyes, America! Here she is, America's worst mother. America's bravest mother, America's worst photographer, or America's greatest photographer, depending on who's talking, as an anonymous high school junior, sporting the same light blouse, dark skirt combo and fake smile as the other girls. Look for a face with wide-set eyes and bangs at the end of the camera club's second row. Lily Preston, who was never elected to class, office, or most or best anything. Other than Honor Society, this was the only high school club she was in. Don't blame me for the pencil marks. I never touched my mother's photos. The first circled face is her photography teacher, Mr. Clark. The second is the camera club's president, Sam Decker, the best photographer no one ever heard of. That description, which Lillian added whenever she showed off this picture, was the only time I heard her deploy anything resembling sarcasm. Apparently, my mother started writing Sam when she was a high school senior, at which point he'd already enlisted in the Army and was serving in Korea. As far as I know, she never showed anyone else the letters she sent to him, the drafts of which she wrote in her journal. And because I only ever violated her privacy in the usual places, her bedside table, her bureau, beneath her mattress, I never found them. Not that I considered her photo boxes any more sacred than her underwear drawer, but at the time of my rabidly dysfunctional adolescence, not to be confused with my rabidly dysfunctional adulthood, fooling with those boxes would have implied an interest in her photography. Letter to Sam Decker, June 1953. My dearest darling, I did it. After all these months of writing and planning and worrying, getting on that bus was the second hardest thing I've ever done. The hardest was telling Father that instead of enrolling at Ursuline College, as he and Mother expected, I planned to attend photography classes at the new school. It's funny. Since I was little, I always knew I was meant to live differently from others. I just wasn't sure how or why. And so I earned decent grades and washed the dishes and ironed my skirts and spoke in turn, which led people to see me as a good girl, when really I was just waiting for that different life to reveal itself. Just as I was beginning to worry that waiting was all there would ever be, I picked up a camera. But you know that already. You're the only one who understands when I say that making pictures makes me fully and truly myself. Thanks so much for the early anniversary present. I know how much we both like to complain about the mail, but this time at least, the army came through because it arrived the week before I left for New York. I don't have pierced ears, but they're such lovely earrings that I may need to change that so I can wear them properly. Perhaps in time for our actual anniversary 2 months from now, especially if you're back by then and we can celebrate together. In the meantime, they make marvelous pins to fasten to my blouse. Whenever I look at them, I imagine I was with you in Kyoto during those 5 days on leave. It's hard to believe it's only been 10 months since my first letter introduced you to a certain camera club member who spent her junior year admiring you and your prints without ever saying hello. Even as I rue the distance between here and Korea, I cannot avoid the strange truth of us. Had you stayed in Cleveland, I'd never have summoned the courage to make any introductions at all. If you hadn't enlisted, we'd still be strangers, and I would probably be pinning an Ursuline pennant to my bedroom wall. I won't go into the gory details of Father's reaction after I told him about New York, but when he finally realized he couldn't stop me, he decided he'd rather help than throw me to the wolves. Never in a million years would I have thought I'd be grateful for his asking the pastor about Christian rooming establishments, but Catherine House is nicer than any hotel I'd have been able to afford, and being around other girls who are also new to the city feels a little less like living with strangers. The only problem is that the quiet girl with bangs who sat in the back row in camera club has followed me here. There are days I don't say more than 5 words between getting out of bed and coming back to my room at the end of the day. Luckily, I've got my pictures. I'm taking rolls and rolls of them, and though I haven't developed any yet, the basic amenities here don't include a darkroom, I can see so many of them in my mind that they supply their own sort of company. 2. Young woman with suitcase in the Port Authority bus terminal, New York, 1953. Not Lillian. Compare it to the girl in the camera club photo, and you'll see that young woman's nose is too pointy, and the hair is too dark, not to mention that the body is all wrong. But I think Lillian still saw herself in the person stepping off that bus. Why? Because even though the station around young woman is a big, busy blur, she doesn't seem lost or even alone. One look at her face, and you can tell she's exactly where she wants to be. Letter to Sam Decker, June 1953. It's silly, but back at home, wearing a shirt and coat of Father's on my Saturday photography walks somehow gave me a kind of permission and made me feel less conspicuous. I intended to leave those clothes behind, but in the end, I couldn't imagine stalking New York without my usual camouflage. Every time I put them on, I feel a twinge of guilt, followed by a trace of comfort. So far, I've kept almost completely to the bus station. It's something to do with all those suitcases and all the faces to whom those suitcases belong. There are so many ways to greet a city. Some people look as if they're waiting for someone, but if you keep watching, you'll see that they're not disappointed when no one comes. That's because they're waiting for the city to meet them. And it does. It always does. Thank you.
I should have gone first, you were right. Hi everyone, thanks for coming. Myla, that was a great reading. Dang, now I have to read. And I'm also, unlike Myla, not reading from the very beginning, so I have to give you a little bit of context, which I will try to keep short. So my book, Trust Exercise, is initially set in a high school for gifted and talented performing students, and it follows a group of theater arts students who have a charismatic teacher named Mr. Kingsley they worship. The students include Sarah and David, who've just had a terrible breakup, and also Joelle, who is or was Sarah's best friend. It's their second year at this special performing arts high school. They're sophomores now, and they're finally getting to do a thing that they've been hearing about ever since they arrived as freshmen. they're very excited and frightened. And I hope that that gives you enough context. Ego reconstruction, said Mr. Kingsley. Ego reconstruction requires a foundation. My darling sophomores, 1 year older and wiser than when we first met. What might that foundation be? They wanted so badly to please him, but the question of how never had a clear answer. Say the right thing, but what could that be? Say a deliberately wrong but funny thing? Ask another question in response to his question, as he often did when responding to theirs? Pammy raised her hand, eager and hopeful. Modesty? Mr. Kingsley laughed at her in disbelief. Modesty. Explain why you think so, and please don't be modest. Please flaunt your thought process, Pammy, so maybe I can fathom what it is. Pammy's plump face beneath gold barrettes flushed to the roots of her hair. But she had an odd stubbornness, a capacity to dig in her heels and argue. Pammy was Christian, a disposition unremarkable outside the walls of their school, but within it unsupported, even mocked. And in the previous year, she'd grown used to defending herself. People who have too much ego are stuck up, she said. Being modest is the opposite of being conceited. Let me make one thing clear, said Mr. Kingsley. We can never have too much ego, so long as we're in control of it. The foundation we require for ego reconstruction is ego deconstruction, Mr. Kingsley concluded. They'd all heard about ego deconstruction last year from the then sophomores and now juniors who had constantly harped on the mystery of this while refusing to share even the slightest detail. You'll get there when you get there. You're still freshmen. Don't try to climb a ladder in midair. The last time I checked, you couldn't cross a bridge by starting in the middle, were some of the things they would say. The then sophomores and now juniors who were a strikingly effusive, tight-knit class who seemed to possess some special aura the now sophomores lacked that wasn't just the advantage of age. The then sophomores and now juniors were more photogenic, individually and together. In a school with no athletic program, they gave the impression of a cheerleading corps. Let's form a circle, Mr. Kingsley said. As so often before, they grew uneasily aware of their crotches as they sat down cross-legged and felt the icy touch of the linoleum numbing their asses. Most of them had privately concluded that ego deconstruction, reconstruction was some sort of fleshless orgy, and they were helplessly blushing, their skin crawling with arousal and dread. The wall of mirrors doubled their circle, around which Mr. Kingsley paced in orbit. His gaze was cast somewhere beyond them. His very way of gazing told them plainly how far they fell short. Of last year's sophomores, of their own potential, of the actors he'd known in New York, they felt their deficit all the more sharply because the unit of measure was wholly unknown. Sarah tried to see David, but he'd placed himself near enough to her left or her right that she couldn't see him, while far enough that she couldn't sense him. Would David be chosen? Would Sarah be chosen? Joel, Mr. Kingsley murmured in a tone of regretful admonishment, sadness almost at her failure. But what had Joel done? She was pink year-round, and a summer's worth of sunburn had her mottled and peeling all over her face and down into the cleavage broadly exposed by her tight V-neck top. The new raw pink skin turned bright red at the sound of her name. All the curls of dead, half-peeled skin seemed to rustle with fear. Her surface was disgusting, Sarah thought. Joelle, please stand at the circle's exact center. You're the hub.
Invisible lines radiate out from you to each one of your classmates. These lines are the spokes. Your classmates and you and these spokes make the wheel. You're the hub of the wheel, Joelle. Okay, Joelle said, blushing fiercely, a fountain of blood pounding under her skin. I'd like you to choose one spoke now. Look down the length of that spoke. Someone's at the other end. Someone you're bound to by that spoke passing through you and passing through them. Who's the person you're looking at? The linoleum doesn't feel cold anymore. Please, no, Sarah realizes, staring straight ahead at Joelle's middle, at her soft belly concealed beneath the tight top. I'm looking at Sarah, Joelle says huskily, her voice almost a whisper. Tell her what you observe. You didn't call me all summer, Joelle belatedly chokes out. Go on, Mr. Kingsley says, gazing somewhere miles away. He's not even looking in Joelle's direction. Perhaps he's using the room's giant mirror to watch Joelle's burning skin, her glittering eyes, her too tight top out of the corner of one eye. And I would call you and you wouldn't call back. And I mean, maybe it's me, but it's like, I feel like, stand up for your feelings, Joelle, Mr. Kingsley barks out. We were best friends and you act like you don't even know me. The strangled grief in her voice is far harder to bear than the words. Sarah is frozen, a statue. She's staring blindly at the opposite wall with its door to the hallway as if she could will herself out of this room, and then suddenly it's Joelle who bolts. Joelle stumbles headlong through the circle, practically stepping on Colin and Manuel. She wrenches open the door and, unleashing a wail, disappears down the hall. In her wake, no one breathes. No one looks anywhere but the floor. No one even looks at Sarah. Life is suspended. Abruptly, Mr. Kingsley wheels on Sarah. What are you doing? He demands, and Sarah flinches in alarm. Go after her. Sarah lurches to her feet and out the door, unable to imagine the faces she's leaving behind, even David's. She isn't even able to find where David was in the circle. The halls are deserted, the slippery black and white checkerboard rapping harshly against the hard soles of her boots. Her punk boots, cruel-toed with metal stilettos and three large silver square buckles each. Behind closed classroom doors on the west hall, the freshmen and juniors doze through the requirements, English and algebra, social studies and Spanish. Down the south and east halls, the real life of the school can be heard. The jazz band splashing through Ellington, the lone pianist's hands prancing over the keys in the dance studio, and the thumping of bound, bloody feet. The smoker's courtyard is empty, its sun-bleached benches bearing only acorns from the massive live oak. The outdoor classroom, a walled-in rectangle of grass with a stage at one end, is also empty, its street-side gate padlocked. Sarah wills David, not Joelle, to appear in these secretive places. David to be sitting on the empty smoker's bench. David to be sitting underneath the oak tree. The rear entrance leads to the rear parking lot where the students park and also eat lunch on the hoods of their cars when the weather is good. Joelle is outside the doors, doubled up, honking with sobs. Joelle clearly meant to escape in her car but was slowed by her grief. The keys to her Mazda poke out of one fist. This is the brand new rocket-like little Mazda Joelle bought with cash, more than $10,000 in cash. She once showed Sarah stuffed in a coffee can under her bed. Sarah didn't know where this money came from. Drug sales, she assumed, possibly something else. Each day, Joelle drives the car to a friend's house a few blocks from home and then walks the rest of the way so her parents won't see it. Joelle is not convoluted, but simple, not sullen, but sunny. Yet she has the extensive clandestine life of a career criminal. And this used to enthrall Sarah. Now, Joelle appears stripped bare, her essence exposed. She's just a party girl, overeager to be liked. The insight startles Sarah, not because of its unkindness, but because this, she suddenly knows, is the sort of insight Mr. Kingsley is constantly trying to extract from them. He paced with impatience last year when they told each other, during observations, such things as, "You're a really nice girl," or, "I think you're handsome." Yet at this moment, Sarah equally knows there's a story unfolding into which her true feelings don't fit. She is supposed to hug Joelle, make it up to her. She knows this as surely as if Mr. Kingsley stood there supervising it all. She has the strong feeling he is there. Joelle, precociously fleshy and pungent, so obliviously manifests the carnal that Sarah's own self-conscious carnality becomes disgusting to her, along with her own flesh, her own scent. Joelle's enormous breasts are heavily freckled. Their trapped clefts and creases are constantly sweaty. Joelle's crotch, encased in her jeans, trails an olfactory banner like some sort of sticky night flower to inflame jungle bats. Joelle sleeps with much older men. At school, she disregards boys as if they're not even incipient men. She only has eyes for Sarah. Half closing her eyes, almost grinding her teeth, Sarah takes Joelle into her arms. Joelle clings to her gratefully, soaks her shoulder with tears and slick snot. This is also self-control, Sarah thinks, this brute willing of the self to take action. Until now, Sarah thought self-control was only restraint, not putting the chair through the glass. "I'm really sorry," she hears herself mumbling. "I'm so messed up right now. I didn't mean to seem distant. Things have just been so crazy. What's been going on? I could tell you have stuff going on. I just knew." Soon the counterfeit is complete. Sarah intended to confide in no one, and if someone, Joelle least of all. Now, as if reading a script, she tells Joelle about the decoy tennis racket, the empty snack bar. Confession made, she's in receipt of Joelle's whole devotion again. Joelle's sobs turn to mirth, her abject supplication to glee. Joelle clings to Sarah no longer from the weakness of grief, but to prevent herself rolling merrily on the sidewalk. Having bought back a friendship she no longer wanted by defiling the one thing she cared about most, Sarah knows it doesn't matter that she enjoins Joelle to a secrecy that puts Joelle into raptures. Joelle is practically wrapped like a vine around Sarah as they stumble back into the classroom, and almost literally into David, because they've been gone for so long, class has ended, and David's the first on his feet to escape. At the sight of David, Joelle bursts out laughing and covers her face. David shoulders roughly past Sarah, and Sarah feels bonfires ignite on her skin. Mr. Kingsley, also on his way out, says, as if as an afterthought, "Sarah, come by and see me tomorrow at lunch." Not even David, in the course of escaping, fails to hear the summons or fails to understand what it means. Even Joelle, who has so misunderstood her entire transaction with Sarah, understands what Mr. Kingsley's summons means. Joelle tightens her hot grip on Sarah with sisterly envy. Sarah has become the kind of problem they would all like to be. Thanks.
Thank you both so much for those terrific readings. This is the Q&A portion, so if anyone has a question, just raise your hand. I'll call on you, and we'll get a microphone your way. Would someone like to start us off? Well, Susan, I was terrified of sort of exposing anything about your book by asking you a question. So I think I'm going to stick with structural issues, and for both of you, actually, if you could talk a bit about the structure of the book, because it seems unusual to me. O. Henry came to mind, but that's not really it. And then Myla, just the format of the exhibition catalog, where that came from and why those structures. Were they organic or were they intentional from the start?
And yet we have to expose things to answer the question, right?
Well, please feel free to limit it. I don't want to give anything away. And you shouldn't either, for those of you who've read it.
So for those of you who haven't read it, my book consists of different parts, which I don't think is that huge of a revelation. And the parts maybe aren't what you expect. So it wasn't part of my initial plan in writing the book, actually. It was really organic, by which I assume you mean, and I mean, it kind of happened as the writing was happening. I was writing a story that seemed as if it was very securely taking place in a particular world and had particular characters. And I was also working on this book very intermittently, which is different for me from my usual process, because I was actually trying to write a totally different book that was a screaming failure that I've still never finished. And so each time I was so discouraged by that book that I couldn't go on, I would pick up this other thing that was just for fun, which was very actually helpful in a way, because I didn't assume that anyone would ever see it. So I would take long breaks from it, and one day when the other book was going so poorly that I picked up this thing again after a long break that was probably, 7 to 10 months, it was different. It's very fun to say this and also sort of silly, but it suddenly occurred to me that someone was pissed off about the way the story was unfolding up to now. I just thought, there's someone in this story who's really mad about the way the story is being told. They just don't agree. They just don't agree at all. And in fact, they're probably really angry at me or at the author, whoever the author is. And that idea of an angry person who felt that their story was being told in a way that they didn't agree with really energized me. And that's sort of what took the book into its final form.
Okay.
Yeah.
Myla?
So after the introduction part that I read, you heard me saying numbers, 1, 2. Well, the whole book, the rest of the book is like that, so be ready. It's a catalog, and there's 100-something, I don't remember the number. It's 100-something different photographs. You're going to get descriptions of the photographs in through the daughter of Lillian. You get journal entries. You get letters of Lillian's. You're also going to get interviews from significant people from Lillian's life at various points. And the simple answer to that question is I stole that format. I'm a huge Stephen Milhauser fan, and when I really like an author, I'm a completist. I read everything. And a book of his that is fairly little known is a book of novellas called Little Kingdoms. The middle novella of that book is called something like Catalog of the Exhibition, and it's using descriptions of a painter's works to give kind of a bare outline of that painter's life. But all it does is just provide a very bare outline. And I saw that and I was like, oh, that's cool. You can do a lot more with that. I want to do that. And so I just kind of ran with the structure from there.
Hi, Myla.
Hi.
I was curious because the photographer that you're writing about seems to be an amalgam of three people in my knowledge of things, I read into, Sally Mann, Mayer, the woman who was
Vivian Mayer,
Vivian Mayer, and Diane Arbus, and
three
daughter who, is. So I'm wondering how you, decided, if that's the case, and how you decided to merge this you know, make this one woman?
Sure, that's a great question. So yeah, Lillian Preston is a Frankensteinian creation of actually a bunch of different photographers. And in the back of the book, I list, there's a huge long list, and those three are in there, so I'm impressed. So those three, but like five or six other ones, maybe more, including, but not limited to, Gary Winogrand, Louis Faure, Helen Levitt, I'm remembering as much, I'm a middle-aged lady, I don't remember the other ones, check the back of the book. But I mean, it basically, it started out, I guess this book started out, I lovingly call this my midlife crisis novel, and it started out with me posing the question, is it possible to be both an excellent artist and an excellent parent at the same time? Or if you want to be one, do you have to compromise on the other? And so I started by reading biographies of lots of different kinds of artists, actually. I was reading painters' biographies, photographers' biographies, writers' biographies, and getting really discouraged because I was not finding very heartening answers to the question I was trying to pose. And so most of the photographers, it's just their work that I draw from. Literally, I draw from their work. So there's descriptions of photos. Sometimes I'm describing the literal photograph by one of those people. And because the actual photo is not on the page, I can do whatever I want. You don't have to ask for permission when you're not using the image. So sometimes I just describe the photo as I saw it because I realized it was perfect for Lillian's work. Other times, there would be one corner of the photo that I'd like, and so I'd enlarge that in my mind's eye and make that my photo. Other times, I would kind of change out the subject or change around the composition a little bit, but their original photograph would be the grounding point. And sometimes I just made it up whole cloth. And so that's kind of how the photography thing worked. And then sometimes in the case of Sally Mann, for example, I drew from some of like the issues in those artists' lives. And so the reason that Sally Mann fascinated me is she answered the question, how do I be both a parent and an artist? She's like, I'm just going to combine them. I'm going to make my kids my work. And you know, that had its own set of consequences, which really I found very interesting. And so that's kind of how she got into the book.
Was that intentional for her, that decision? I mean, it was intentional to take pictures of her kids, but she was she trying to ask same question you were asking in the narrative?
You'd have to ask her. But I suspect she wasn't posing it in a conscious way. But we all are. I mean, anyone, you don't have to be an artist. Anyone who has ambition of any kind, anyone who is engaged in their job and their job is not at home, is going to ask that question in their mind, either, you know, concretely and consciously, or it's going to be subconsciously guiding some of their decisions. Mm-hmm. So,
is that something you wrestled with, Susan?
Yeah. I mean, I was just quietly sitting here thinking, you're being so diplomatic about not actually gendering this issue at all, which was interesting to me because I'm sitting here thinking, like, is this a problem that people who aren't women artists deal with?
Well, the reason I guess I'm not gendering it is I think until very recently, it was not a problem. It was a very, very specifically female problem. But I feel like in this generation, like in our generation of partners, it is an emerging problem for fathers. And so I want to give those fathers credit. And so that's why I'm using the word parent. I think in the time of this book, of Lillian's world, and really in our world until, say, 10 years ago, it was a mom problem. But I do think that there are men now that are dealing with that issue, too.
So progress.
Yeah.
I'm curious and wonder if you always have such a clear problem statement for a novel. And I wonder if you do as well. It didn't sound like it.
Do you?
No. This is the very first time that this kind of emerged. Like, I didn't usually know. I just start a book fascinated by a topic or by a character. But this book started as a crisis for me. You know, this book took me about 10 years to write, more like 8.5 or 9. My daughters are now 15 and 11, so when I started writing it, I'm not going to be able to do the math in front of all these people, but it was something like, you know, younger. They were significantly younger, much more high maintenance. And I just knew I was not getting the work done. And so I just, you know, I had to start this book as a way to just kind of figure out how do you live? How do you do this?
Yeah, same answer to your question. I almost never have like a, what did you call it, a problem statement? Yeah, no, I never have a, I mean, if I do, it's something, it's not like framed as an issue, but more framed as like a very specific human situation that I'm interested in. With this book, what was interesting to me was
the situation of, this started as, you know, a side project and also something I hoped would be a short story. I was hoping it would be very small and that its concerns therefore had to be limited. I failed on that count, as I always do. But initially it was just a breakup story. It was about a pair of young lovers who break up and their breakup doesn't go unnoticed by their teacher and their teacher kind of meddles. And that was the problem that I was sort of writing about, but it ballooned.
Can I ask her a question?
Please.
Would that be okay? No. So I love the sex in your book. I think that you write about teenage sex with an immediacy and a passion that reminded me, oh, right, that's what it used to feel like, you know? Like, I mean, because I feel like, you know, when it's first new and exciting and it's like this whole universe, and so you're able to do that. And I guess my question for you is, was that just, how hard was it to get yourself to a place where you could be there, or did it just come, no pun intended, when you were writing it? Like, how did that happen for you?
Just need a minute. To choose different words, thanks. That's really, really nice to hear. Maybe this like is disturbing and says something about me that we don't want to reflect on too much, but I didn't actually have to work to kind of get there. So what does that mean?
That's great. You're living a good life.
Or it means that I like have had severely arrested development, possibly, as psychosexual stunted person. But I think it's really interesting that you said that because, you know, when this book, so this is a book about teenagers that, in my opinion, is not for them. Someone asked me if I would let my own teenager read this book, and I like gasped with horror and went, oh, no. So that's my answer. But it is in part about teenage characters and then the characters, not to give too much away, but they aren't teenagers throughout the whole book. And so when this book was first being read, I was really challenged by a reader who told me that there was just no way that teenage human beings would relate to each other sexually in the way that they do in this book. And I was so sort of shocked and actually like crestfallen by that response. I mean, this person essentially said to me, like, this is completely unrealistic, I don't buy it. And I was like, really? So thank you for buying it. But I do think that like the key to writing those scenes of intimacy between very young people was not thinking of them that way. Like not thinking, oh, this is a scene of intimacy between very young people, but just thinking, this is a scene between two people who are like crazy about each other and don't actually know how to communicate that.
So I have a question. Does the banjo playing support the writing or vice versa?
The banjo playing is just what I do by myself in my basement. It doesn't support anything. But music, I guess, more broadly speaking, music is sort of the creative antithesis to writing for me. When I write, I'm alone in a room, I'm monomaniacal, it's, you know, me being God. And when I play music, I always work extremely collaboratively with a group of people. And there's no front person. It's a completely democratic musical effort. And so I love that. I love that sort of creative society that it gives me and the energy it gives me. So they feed each other in that way, I would say.
Hi. I'm a librarian, and I'm reading your book. I'm actually listening to it, which is really fun, because you really feel like the teenage angst in the way it's being read in the book. So I highly recommend, for those of you who haven't, the audiobook is really good.
Oh, but it is? That's great to hear. I myself haven't heard it yet.
Oh, okay.
I just haven't had time. I'm sorry to cut in on your question. Yeah, but fine. I was really excited. I was given the opportunity to weigh in on the readers, on the performers. And I was really excited about them, so.
So I'm really interested, like, you're an academic, right? You're at Yale, you teach, and you're writing. And I have a daughter who is trying to be in academia. And I'm just wondering, like, how do you do that? Like, how do you balance all the demands of being an academician and also write in such a creative way?
Oh, thank you. I should clarify, though, I'm not an academic it's a sore subject in my family. I dropped out of my doctoral program without finishing. I'm not even like ABD. I'm just like maybe A. I intended to be an academic. I was going to be an English professor. Like my plan for it's like so much less interesting than playing banjo, was that I would be an English professor and write novels on the side. And really early on, it became clear to me that I couldn't even pursue both forms of school. So I teach creative writing at Yale, but I'm definitely like at the very bottom of the totem pole where all the people without advanced degrees kind of cluster. So, but that said, I spend a lot of time in academic environments and do find them home-like, I guess. My father's a math professor, so I grew up in the world of academia, and I think have always hewed closely to it out of fear of the outside world and having to work through the summer. Although now I teach all summer long, so it sort of doesn't work. But I think my balance issues are much more the ones that Myla writes about in her book. They're much more about trying to balance raising a family with being a writer than they are trying to balance like the two halves of my writing life. Wow, well, I'm sure we both have a lot to say about it. Yeah, I mean, it's a constant challenge and constantly evolving. Myla and I actually have children who are very remarkably similar in age. Hers are 11 and 15, mine are 11 and 14. So I don't know if you would agree with this, but I have felt in the past handful of years as if my life is in the process of changing almost as radically as it changed when my children were born, in a way that's really exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, suddenly they do stuff on their own. All of a sudden they just leave the house in the morning and you're like, and then they're gone for hours. So I don't know how that's been for you, but for me, it's, I mean, it hasn't actually in an immediate way made it easier to work because I've spent a lot of time in the past few years like trying to even remember who I am, to be honest. And I think that as my kids continue to like go through their teenage years and probably head off to college, hopefully I'll be able to take the time that I now have that is so much greater than the time that I did have and use it better. But like I do feel kind of like I've just been stumbling around in a candy store for the past few years going like, whoa, what do I do now? I'm not more efficient. I was so much more efficient when my children were babies. And I had like 3 hours in 2 days to myself. And I would just like write like a maniac. Now I just waste time all the time. What do you do? Are you being efficient?
I'm being efficient.
Dang.
I have to admit. I live a highly fascistically compartmentalized life. And I guess the survival strategies that I carved out when my kids were small, I have hewn to with desperation. Mm. I haven't let them go. And so, yeah, there's times I close the door and nothing will get me out. You know, it doesn't matter what's on fire or who's bleeding. I'm going to stay and I'm going to assume someone else is going to take care of it. Or now they're old enough to take care of themselves. That's the beauty of it. They can, like, feed themselves. And if they hurt themselves, they know where the Band-Aids are. It's awesome. But I guess in answer to your question, I mean, and just... So yeah, I mean, the big struggle for me was I wanted to, when I was with my family, I felt that I was taking away from the writing. When I was doing the writing, I felt like I was taking away from the family. So it was always something was losing. I always felt like, you know, conflicted and like I was not doing my job at one thing or another. And kind of when I was in the middle of that, one of the things that just saved me was a retrospective of Louise Bourgeois's work at the Guggenheim. I went to see that, and she's a fantastic artist who, she's done a little bit of everything. She's done painting. She's more known for her sculpture, probably. She's done assemblages. And so I was going, and the cool thing about the Guggenheim is it's a spiral, right? And so when they have a retrospective, it kind of goes chronologically. You start at the bottom, and you go to the top. And I was working through her life's work. And so she was very prolific in her younger years. And then she had kids. She had at least three. Definitely three, maybe more. And sure enough, when she had the kids, her output slowed considerably, but then the kids grew up. And then she emerged from the other side of that. And the work that I saw at that retrospective that she had done after the heavy usage, you know, years of her parenting were done, it was better work, it was more interesting work, it was more nuanced work, it was more exciting work. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. This whole being a parent thing, this whole being a mother thing, it's additive. You know, like by being a mother, I'm becoming a better human. And by becoming a better human, I'm becoming a better artist. And that
just, I, all of a sudden I could breathe a little bit better. And I was like, okay, it's going to take me more time now. And I'm going to be having colleagues who, they're still fast because they either don't have kids or they have nannies who take care of them 24 hours a day or whatever, and I don't have that. But I made my peace with it after that, and I realized that everything was helping the other thing rather than taking away from the other thing. So that was sort of my big thought balloon in the process of writing this book and being a parent.
Can I follow up on one aspect of that that has actually nothing to do with being a parent, but has more to do with, are you still at Sarah Lawrence?
Me?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm what they call guest faculty, which means I'm a migrant adjunct, so I just teach there one class every fall.
An obvious question that I have for both of you is the quality of the work that you're seeing and the promise in the students. Do we have a lot to look forward to?
I would say yes. I'm seeing, I don't know about you, but so I teach writing at the college level, and I have never seen better student writing at any point in my career. I've been teaching for 25 years, and I've never seen better student writing than I'm seeing now. And they are busting a lot of stuff open in ways that I didn't do when I was a student. My students are writing stuff that is very, they are not loyal to genre. They are really worried about the state of our world, as they have every freaking reason to be. And they're finding ways to deal with that in their fiction that are really brave and interesting.
Is this grad or undergrad?
Undergrad.
That's really cool.
Undergrad. Well, I think it's in part because they're not graduate students. They don't have this pre-professional feeling of like, oh, will someone buy this? They just are having a creative outlet, I guess, for a lot of their fears and hopes.
One thing that's been notable to me, and this is sort of I feel like in our age, I'm seeing a lot more fear. I'm seeing students who are terrified of writing about certain things because they're afraid of what people are going to call them or what people are going to say or what people are going to think. So I always devote the first month of the class to just letting them know, guys, the whole reason we write is to go anywhere our imaginations lead us. And in this class, that's what you need to do. And so I really work on building their trust and creating a space where they can write about anything that they want to write about and know that it's going to be okay to do that. And that makes me sad. I think it's a cyclical thing. I think we just happen to be in a period where there's like a lot more fear than there used to be.
Boy, I hope it's cyclical. Please join me in thanking Myla Goldberg and Susan Choi.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.